Hello, and thank you for listening to Renewables, a podcast by BioStar, which aims to explore the current and future energy landscape in America.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Renewables. I'm your host, David Smart, Senior Vice President of Sales at BioStar Renewables. And welcome back to part two of our 2020 Super 6 Organic Fertilizer Field Trials with Chief Agronomist Alan Filo. Alan, thank you for being back on the show.
It's good to be here again.
We're excited to dig in. Really appreciated your time and going through the results from the 2020 field trials in last episode. If you missed that, back up one episode, go listen to the field trials. There's a presentation on there as well that you can follow along if you go and find us on YouTube. So we're going to dive in a little bit deeper though today. There was a lot of information there. We went through it kind of quickly because there's so much to cover. Going to dive in a little bit deeper and talk about, you know, the crop trials, but also some of the other solutions that we provide and some of the other problems we solve related to manure management, and soil health and other topics like that. So Alan, thanks again for being back. And I just want to start with the crop trials. We had some questions come in from users. Thank you to everyone who attended our sneak peek webinar and asked questions. Really appreciate that. One of the questions that popped up was how many years of trials have you completed and how many do you need to do going forward? I think you have maybe 1 year in certain crops, 2 years in other crops. So what's typical? How many have you completed and how many do you expect to complete going forward?
So typically we want to do 3 years on a given crop. And the reason for that is that helps to even out the different weather events that are going to occur within a single growing season. Remember, that's one of the, when you're thinking about crop trials, you're trying to control variables. And no matter how hard we seem to have tried, we can't figure out how to control the weather. So one of the ways that you get around that is to do these trials for multiple years. So 3 years is usually what we shoot for. We've done 3 years of crop of corn trials if you were to go back and count the farmer trials, but I really like to even make it that this is the trials that we've done that are from third-party research firms, so that what you're doing is controlled small plot experiments where you make sure that you're going to get good statistical methodologies in place as well. So we are actually, we should be getting data back this winter for the third year of corn trials, which will wrap that up. We're going to go into our second year of wheat trials and our second year of vegetable trials. That was a little bit, that might seem strange to some people if you've been paying attention, because our first vegetable trials were done between 2019 and 2020. But because of COVID, we weren't able to actually have those done this last year due to labor shortages. So we've had to skip a year, but we're going to be restarting some of those. I actually would have to go through and carefully count the number of trials that we've completed. I know that in 1 year alone, we completed something like 11 different corn trials, all the way from North or South Dakota to Tennessee. So that was pretty extensive. And I would say that I'm hoping that we will have all of our trialing wrapped up within another 2 years, which is probably going to, the one that's going to be taking the time is rice. I think that we're going to be able to also do our second trial of rice this next year, but we might have to wait another year. So I would actually pin 2023 as the last year of trial results.
And talk a little bit more about some of the partners that we're utilizing from a third party standpoint. Let's just give them a little bit of love, some of the partners that we've been executing these trials with.
Sure. So here in Wisconsin, we've been using Dr. Tim Maloney at, and you know what, I don't have the name of his firm right in front of me, but maybe we can attach that in the notes to this particular.
Absolutely. Podcast. Yep.
And he's been doing this for like 20 years. His farm is really organized. It's a really nice place to go visit. I can pop over there and be there in about an hour and a half to take a look at how the trials are doing and to consult with him. We're going to be doing wheat trials again with him. And then down for the vegetable trials, we've been going mainly to a company called RD for Ag, which is Dr. Steve West in Yuma, Arizona. They have a lot of really good capabilities to do the vegetable trials and to do the vegetable trials in the environment where most of these vegetables are grown. There are places I could go in the Midwest to do vegetable trials, but you want to center your trials in the place where the weather conditions and the soil types and everything are as much like as the major markets as possible. So that's where we'll be doing spinach, celery, broccoli, and maybe spring mix again this upcoming year.
Excellent. Yeah, I think you mentioned a couple things that I think are particularly interesting. One is, I think a lot of people associate climate, which, you know, soil quality is obviously has something to do with climate, but that was one of my questions that you sort of answered. How important is it to do certain trials in certain regions? And I think sort of looking at the whole, I think, you know, agronomic suitability of a climate, including soil, is really interesting. And we're going to get into that here in a little bit later about Super 6, our product, and how it promotes soil health and sort of closes nutrient loops in our ag system, which was something that you mentioned in episode one that I want to dig in on a little bit. That a lot of our trials, you're actually trialing our product with other types of product. And you have a lot of experience in your career, you know, prior to and now at BioStar, helping develop complete fertility plans. So talk a little bit about the importance of trialing and mixing our product with other products in these trials.
Yeah. So there's kind of two stages or two parts to that. The first thing I'll say is that when you're looking at organic agriculture, very rarely are you looking at one product acting alone. You're always going to be, and I think I mentioned this in that trial podcast, that trial webinar, that what you're always working with in an organic system is actually the biology in the soil. They are what is releasing the nutrients, what from your base fertility applications, or usually from your product into the soil. And there's different ways that we can work with that. When we're mixing our product with other products, what we're usually trying to do is make that product more suitable and more interesting to biology so that they're going to go and utilize that product in ways just beyond the strict nutrient percentage that's in our product. So basically they're going to leverage it up, right? They're going to take that nitrogen, they're going to leverage it up, use it to build more of their bodies and their populations and turn around and eat more of whatever the base fertility application is. Our base fertility applications that we've done this on, we've done some things where the base fertility application is products like feather meal, but usually we like to, the most commonly used base fertility product is really just manure, some sort of dehydrated, heat-treated manure that, and the reason they heat-treated is basically to just destroy any pathogens that are inside the manure, but it does change some of the physical characteristics of it. But we're running the trial with that because that's typically just what people need to do to get their base fertility application. It's important to note that with our products, with pretty much any liquid product that you're going to encounter in organics, those products are not suitable to somehow provide like all of the, even the nitrogen for a crop for the entire year on a number of levels. It's not really suitable in the way that the product is built, but it's also not really suitable in terms of cost. You know, these The liquid products are at a higher price point because there's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of capital investment that goes into making them and a lot of science that's gone into making them. And what we're always trying to do with that, again, is leverage up the less expensive base fertility inputs like manures.
That's a perfect segue because I wanted to talk about manure on this episode. And I also wanted to talk about, you know, sort of the other services that you're able to provide to farmers with respect to fertility planning and other services that you're able to provide to RNG developers also, which is kind of interesting, and we'll get to that later. But with respect to manure, there's a lot of manure out there. There's a lot of issues and expenses related to manure handling. Talk a little bit now, especially for folks who are maybe looking at this from a higher level, just some of the kind of what are farmers doing with this manure now? What are some of the pitfalls that we know from land applying this? Because you're talking about a lot of manure and applying it all over the place. Talk a little bit about that. What do they do with it now? And what are the pitfalls of sort of how most people handle the manure now?
So yeah, before I start that, I think I want to say unequivocally that manure is not a bad thing. The problem is always when you get too much manure in the wrong place. And that is what we're seeing in agriculture today. This doesn't have to do anything. I mean, farmers make decisions, companies make decisions about how they organize their companies, but they're always doing it within the context of a system, and farmers are operating within kind of the contextual environment of different subsidy programs, different programs that we have in government and the national level. And that is continually pushing animal agriculture into more and more tightly spaced centers. A lot of these, you can end up with a lot of animals in one location. You know, if you were to go look at the average size of a dairy, for instance, over the past 50 to 70 years in Wisconsin, you would see that, you know, 50 years ago, 70 years ago, these numbers aren't perfectly accurate, but might have been 30 cows. And now it's like, you know, the upper limit is like 5,000. So, you know, if you think about a lot of small farms dotting the landscape, all with 30 cows, you can see that there's probably not a whole lot of problem with manure in that sense. But when I talk about putting 5,000 cows in one spot, you know, and maybe like what amounts to 2 acres of barns, that's the equivalent of a 500,000 person city on 2 acres. You know, that's an incredibly dense population. And now this manure, which on its own, what if it's spread out in the environment like it used to be, is not hazardous. When it's all concentrated in one point, now it becomes a hazardous problem. It can become a problem in terms of odor. It can become a problem in terms of storage. If you have large amounts of manure like that, they break containment. You can damage riparian systems. So that's like stream systems and water bodies. And that's even before we get to like, well, then now how do we apply it to the land? So it's in those situations, what's happening is that we're concentrating those animals in that spot because a lot of the infrastructure that goes into building a farm is like that base farm infrastructure in terms of the facilities for keeping the animals, the facilities for milking the animals. Concentrating all of these kind of like high cost farm items in one spot to service as many cows as possible. And then it's also fairly easy to bring in the agricultural goods that you're going to need from a surrounding land base to that location. It's just sort of, it's part of what the cost of raising those animals is. But then what's happened over time is that manure regulation didn't really catch up with that. It kind of got caught flat-footed. And so what started happening is there was overapplication of manures on land surrounding these facilities. And what happens is that there are certain things that get concentrated in the manures at higher rates than they're usually concentrated on the landscape, and that where they're not taken off by crops at the same rate as they're being applied. If you're using manures, the most common is phosphorus. My guess is that somewhere someone has, if you're listening to this podcast, you have heard about phosphorus issues damaging water bodies. One of the most biggest examples of that is the algae blooms that they've had in Lake Erie on the south side of Lake Erie, northern Ohio. And this is coming from really high phosphorus soils building up over time, those soils washing into water bodies and those water bodies making their way into Lake Erie. It creates a situation where there's a lot of phosphorus in the water, which is a limiting factor for algae growth. And then the algae takes off and blooms. And then you get weird things, like you can create hypoxic conditions because the microbes, the algae, these different things growing, start growing at a rate faster than oxygen can diffuse in and out of water. So it can suck all the oxygen out of water. And then you can get things like fish die-off because aquatic organisms relying on the oxygen in that water don't have the oxygen and they suffocate, right? So there's a lot of ways in which these manure problems make their waves literally farther downstream and are affecting riparian water systems farther downstream. So, and part of that just is also related to, for instance, here in Wisconsin, we have another problem up in the northeast corner of something called karst soils. So these are fairly thin soils that go to bedrock. And so what's happening is that you can both get this runoff from the top, but occasionally you can also get, you know, other, it might not be phosphorus in this case, but you can get nitrate pollutants or E. coli pollutants and things like this going down through the soil. It's getting into people's well water. It's, you know, which is having a direct impact on people's health. So then the question becomes, well, what kind of solutions do you have for these sorts of problems? Well, one of the solutions is to truck the manure farther away and to get it on soils that are able to take these kinds of manure applications. But there's a problem with that, which is that water or manure has a huge amount of water in it, right? Because when we talk about manure, you're not just talking about like a cow patty, you're also talking about all of the urine and all of the very liquid feces that is created in these different environments. Could be a swine facility too, could be a chicken facility. Any of these facilities, they have very similar issues. So you end up with a lot more water in that end product than you do in the agricultural feedstocks than you were bringing in the first place. That's why it's economic to truck those feedstocks into the farm, but it becomes very uneconomic to try to transport this manure away. You can get, and it doesn't sound like a lot when I say this, right? It's like, well, you might spend 2 cents per gallon just moving this manure farther away, or 4 cents per gallon, until you start calculating out just how much manure one of these cows makes, which I think could be, you know, even if we went with a low end estimate of like 20 gallons per day of manure, if I have 5,000 cows in a spot, that's, what is that, 100,000 gallons per day? I mean, it's just a ridiculous amount of manure. And then you can see that if I'm having to truck that away every day at 2 cents per gallon, I now suddenly have this big line item in my budget that is a problem. Sure. So that's not necessarily an economic solution. So more and more what's happened is that we've tried to come up with ways to reduce the volume of those things that might need to be moved around, and also to separate out the different nutrients from one another, because the different nutrients end up in different parts of the manure as you separate different parts of the manure out. So one thing that you can do to reduce volume is you can run those manures through an anaerobic digester. That has the added benefit, of course, of producing methane, which is a carbon neutral. If it's biomethane, it's a carbon neutral energy source. And you can clean that up and put it straight into the energy pipeline. So that's a huge benefit. But that only does about a 30% reduction in volume. And you still have all this water that's going to come out of that digester. So then what we're going to end up doing is start to basically separate the solids from the water. But then in the end, what you end up with is a water that still isn't necessarily suitable for direct land application because it has a high nutrient content. right? And that's where Super 6 and these different technologies come in, is that they're able to remove what is the most expensive thing to transport around and what has the most value at the actual location where you're moving it, which is, can you get the water back to clean water? I mean, you could say that we're a, I like to say to people, like, I can tell you that we're a fertilizer producing company, but I could also just tell you that we're a water cleanup company. You know, if we have 100,000 gallons of manure,
waste management company,
waste management, we can make 78,000 gallons of potable water, you know, from that manure and 1200 gallons of fertilizer.
Now, right. Say that again, because I interrupted you. So say that statistic again, 100,000 coming in.
It's like 100,000 gallons of manure comes in. We make 78,000 gallons of clean water, and we make 1,200 gallons of manure. And then you have some, of fertilizer. And then you have some solids in between that also still have other things that we can potentially do with them. So that's how you can really start to solve these problems, is to get the water clean and then get the nutrient dense solids or liquids into forms that can be transported away from these farms and back out into the agricultural landscape. And that's where we really get into, you know, like closing nutrient loops and things like that.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because talk a little bit about some of the benefits of Super 6 besides, you know, this waste management issue that is absolutely a growing issue. You're seeing states across the country start to ban organic waste from being landfilled, and there's penalties that are coming down the chute with that. And then there's a big need, obviously, for qualified recycling centers. So the waste management piece is huge, but talk a little bit about what makes Super 6 different when you close that loop and put it back into the agricultural system, right? So how do the crops react differently to our product as opposed to just land applying manure?
So when you're land applying manures, especially for organic agriculture, while those manures do have a certain amount, if you're going to apply them raw, let's start with that. If you're going to apply them raw, they do have certain a certain amount of the nutrients in them are plant available right away. But then there's also problems with the fact that those manures contain a lot of microbial contaminants like E. coli and Salmonella. So in organic agriculture, there are restrictions on how close to harvest, especially if it's something some human is going to eat, how close to harvest you can apply those. And it's typically 120 days from harvest. So if you think, like, for short run crops, like vegetable crops, spinach, even, you know, broccoli, which is one of the longer run organic field crop vegetable crops, you're going to have to apply that manure at least a month before you would even start planting. And in some cases, 2 or 3 months before you would start planting. Well, in that time period, almost all of those soluble nutrients that would be available would wash away, right? Mm-hmm. Now there's other things that you can do to kind of help with that. You could plant a cover crop on top of it and turn the cover crop in. But in that case, what's happening again is you're taking all of the soluble nutrients and you're tying them up into some plant form. And so you can't get the benefits of those soluble nutrients into your plants right away. And you are going to be relying on microbial activity in the soil to break down whatever is either left of the solids or whatever green manure crop you put on to suck up those soluble nutrients. The other option is to take those manures and to, you know, treat them in some way. So that could be like a heat treatment, like I talked about. That raises the cost of the manure, obviously, because you're handling it, you're expending energy to dry it. And so that becomes a more expensive product. And then you're still in this situation where when you dry it, usually often many of the most ammonium, for instance, what we often deal with is very volatile. When you heat it, it disappears in the steam as it goes through the drying process. So often you're losing nutrients out of the manure. When you do that, what nutrients are left, again, have to go through the microbial cycle. And then, or you could make compost out of it, right? Everybody thinks compost is great. Compost is really good stuff. But again, there's a lot of work that goes into compost. So you kind of end up with these same things again. Well, it's going to, you know, cost more because it takes a lot of handling to make a really good compost product. You do lose certain nutrients in the composting process. And again, you're going to be relying on microbial breakdown to release all those nutrients into the soil environment. So what happens with Super 6 is, first, from just an environmental side, we're not letting these nutrients escape back into the environment, where some of them can become even air pollutants. Ammonium, when it volatilizes as ammonia into the atmosphere, actually helps create small microparticle pollution. Interestingly enough, COVID, which for the most part has not been very beneficial, has allowed us to see this really clearly. There was a study that came out around Milan, Italy, where during the shutdown, you know, air pollution kind of just went away, right? But they noticed that in this one section around Milan, air pollution levels were still really high. And it turned out that it was all from land-applied manure. And the ammonia that was volatilizing from the land-applied manure and making this really small particulate air pollution. So, you know, there are issues even with that escaping from the environment. So first of all, we're capturing those things. We're not allowing that to happen. But then when it gets into the soils, you know, we can look at it from a plant perspective and we can look at it from a soils perspective. Now, from a plant perspective, like on a short run crop, we can often what's done is that in order to get enough nutrients breaking down fast enough to supply that crop with enough nitrogen and potassium and things, you get massive overapplication of manures or compost in that system. That both raises the cost of what is being produced because you're paying for that large application. And it also potentially also has environmental degradation benefits because that manure, even though it might be necessary for that crop right there, right then, it's going to start then breaking down faster and faster as it goes through that process. And the next crop or that particular crop may not be able to even pick up all those nutrients, and you can get pollution of water bodies because those nutrients now are coming out of that manure, that compost, too fast to be picked up by the plants, and they get into the water. So when you introduce Super 6 into that, you can get the benefit of it, first of all, feeding the plant in that case. That does happen. But even more so, you can increase the amount of microbial activity going on to break down those bulk applications. So you can cut down on those applications, reducing the danger of those bulk applications becoming a pollutant, right? And also reducing the total overall cost to the growing of that crop. So that's one of those ways where getting that ammonium, you know, is how many benefits did I name there? I mean, it was at least three or four just environmental benefits before we ever got to the point where, by the way, it made a better crop, you know? So there's a lot to stacking all of these benefits on top of each other.
Yeah, well, and it's, you know, the product in so many different ways. We talk about closing the loop. We should probably have a graphic up here that shows the loop, which we will work on. But, you know, you're really talking about promoting and creating healthier soils that are going to, you know, in turn produce good, healthy crops for future generations. One of the things you've mentioned to me in the past was, you know, you've seen a lot more flooding and, you know, a lot of naturally occurring weather disasters. And there's a lot of different reasons that fires are happening out west and flooding's happening and hurricanes and everything like that. But I had never thought about the ability of the soil to absorb water and needing healthy soil to be able to do that. And that's something that you mentioned to me a couple episodes that has kind of stuck with me and I think about all the time because you're seeing all this flooding in the Midwest and, well, why is that happening? And, you know, it's not because there's a giant hurricane right there. It's deeper rooted than that. And so I think I actually am thinking live on this podcast, we are going to develop a closed nutrient loop graph that we will find a place to feature and make sure that anyone who listened to this episode is able to see. But there's so many different components to this, from soil health and producing healthy crops, all the way, like you said, to manure management and mitigating what we're landfilling and paying attention to these landfill diversion laws, because I think they're going to become more and more important. We talk a lot about landfill capacity on our website and talk about how quickly we're running out of landfill capacity. We used to ship a lot of our trash to China. We're not doing that anymore. Some folks estimate inside of 15 years of landfill capacity remaining in this country. So obviously this helps to solve that problem as well, from a manure standpoint, but also, some of our digesters are using food waste as well that's being diverted from landfill. So
to kind of build on that, that's one of the places where, like, if you want to talk about a broken nutrient loop, that's one of the biggest ones. When we're putting nutrients onto crops and then taking those crops and using them as humans, and then take, even if you think about, like, if you get a fresh cabbage, and you bring it into your house, how much of that cabbage do you peel away before you would ever get to the part of the cabbage you would eat, right? You might only eat 60% of the cabbage that even brought in. And before that, I'm going to tell you, there was probably another 50% of the cabbage that got trimmed off somewhere else.
Right. So that it looked pretty enough for you to buy, right?
That's correct. And so you have both, at that point, you have both pre-consumer and post-consumer food waste that the last century, we've just been taking and we throw it in the garbage and it goes into the garbage and it goes into the landfill, where it creates all sorts of problems. But also all of the nutrients that were trapped in that are just gone. We don't have any ability to take them and put them back onto a field. And what's interesting about that too is those took energy to produce. Those don't come from nowhere. Often they're mined. Potassium is often a mined substance. On the conventional side, we're actively burning natural gas to fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere. And when that nitrogen, there's an actual carbon footprint now to that nitrogen in that cabbage that we're talking about. And the last thing we want to do is then just throw that nitrogen into a landfill. So we want to be able to make sure that nitrogen ends up back in some usable form to go back into a cabbage again. There's no reason for it to escape into the environment or into a groundwater system where it becomes a pollutant. So there's actual carbon footprint, reductions when we're talking about these technologies too. And that goes bigger. That goes even bigger if we want to talk about some of the other capabilities that we're developing with other firms to do even more nutrient recovery technologies.
Yeah, I actually think that's a good segue. I just wanted to direct people. We have some resources on our website and some really interesting statistics that we pulled from various places. And this one always amazes me. In 2017, the U.S. generated 260 million tons of municipal solid waste, 70% of which was organic materials, which I just find fascinating. And then this one, 30% of all food produced is wasted, which equals about almost 2 billion tons per year of food waste. And wasted food accounts for $172 billion in wasted water, if you consider the fact that the water that it took to grow that food that was then wasted was wasted. That actually comes out to nearly 25%. Of our water supply in this country, which is just amazing to think about. So, but I do want you to quickly touch on some of the things you're doing with other folks in our space. We're obviously out developing renewable gas projects, and there's a market in California called the LCFS market that most of these types of projects are selling their gas into. I think there's over 400 projects current or planned. So there's a lot of developers in our space, but touch quickly, you alluded to it on some of the things. If you're listening to this and you're an RNG developer and you're, you know, kind of trying to figure out the back end, you know, of the plant and what to do with kind of what's left over, talk a little bit about some of the services and some of the help you can provide to folks like that.
Yeah. I think that when people first started getting into the LCFS market, you know, there was a temptation to just look at everything that came out of the back end of those anaerobic digester processes as like, well, that's just waste. You know, we've got what we wanted out of this, and this is just waste. But I think more and more there's the recognition that that is not waste, that there's value in what is coming out of that, especially if we can figure out ways, as I've alluded to basically fractionate out or capture nutrients in different ways. So, you know, for our process, we can capture most of the nitrogen and the potassium that is leaving into effluent water at the backside of that. But then there's other things that can be captured in other ways. There's a lot of phosphorus that at different points in that can be extracted with different nutrient extraction technologies. Now, these don't necessarily go into organic agriculture, but they have value inside conventional agriculture. Most people have heard at some point, you know, whether they think it's true or not, of a concept called peak oil, right? And but there's fairly large agreement in the agricultural community that we have passed something called peak phosphorus, which phosphorus is a major macro necessary nutrient for growing crops, and there is a finite supply of good phosphorus bearing rocks in the world that you can then process to make phosphorus fertilizers. So, and phosphorus is also one of the main issues that you get with many of the land applications of manure that we discussed earlier. So there's other technologies like struvite or brushite extraction technologies that we're working presently with other firms and other engineers, both to make sure that we have markets, places where we can take these products and they have value in the market. And they're easily monetizable. And then also in just having engineering solutions to have different options to basically process waste streams in multiple ways. And then another one that we've been looking at a lot lately and that we're developing capabilities for is biochar. It's interesting to note that there traditionally biochar has a number of issues with it in terms of its monetizability and as a product and being able to get back what the investment is to make it, you know, on large scales. But as carbon markets have developed, people are recognizing that when you make biochar, you're actually stabilizing the carbons. You're truly stabilizing these carbons into forms where they're stable for hundreds, thousands, possibly tens of thousands of years. And so as an actual carbon reduction solution, and it provides real benefit to soils in terms of water storage capacity and nutrient storage capacity. And you know, the problem with things like struvite and brushite and biochar in the past have been that there are basically like better, cheaper alternatives in terms of what you could apply in order to get a crop yield difference right away. But as we've gained a lot more understanding in how those kinds of things, basically what happens often is agriculture is sort of externalizing these costs. We're purchasing a cheap input. We put it on our fields. We put it on our fields in excess. It runs off of our fields and it can create issues for surrounding communities. That's like the definition of an externalized cost. We're having to figure out how to re-internalize those costs. And when we re-internalize those costs, what it does is it creates value for products that before were created waste products, like the products I've talked about. And so, you know, for the carbon, people are now seeing that, hey, this is a way of stabilizing carbon. I'll buy a carbon credit on that. So there are becoming ways in which the carbon, that biochar now has a value, a base value before it ever even gets sold into an agricultural community, right? Mm-hmm. And that allows the price to come down for the farmer because society is valuing it on a different level. Same things for struvite and brushite, all of these different technologies. So we feel that, we're starting to work and offer these services to develop to other developers, not just for our own purposes, that the more of these nutrient capture and nutrient recycling technologies that we can put together with the energy, you know, capture technologies, the more, you know, back to that closed loop idea, the more we can close these loops, the less energy we need to expend, you know, mining phosphorus in Morocco, or mining potassium in Russia. And you know, there's even a certain amount of, you know, people wanted more domestic oil production. So we're less reliant on that globally. And you could say the same thing about a lot of these nutrients. So
it's really interesting, Alan. You're doing a great job, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on and do these podcasts with us and educate our listeners. I know a lot of the folks listening are folks that follow you closely, but we also have, you know, folks from sort of all different backgrounds and in all different industries listening. And I think you do a great job of bridging the gap, you know, between the scientific piece of it and sort of helping us everyday folk, if you will, really understand the importance of Super 6 product, yes, but also, you know, this bigger picture of how are we handling waste and how are we helping the ag community continue to become more sustainable. There's a lot of folks out there, I think, that it's really easy to catch on social media or find who kind of want to act like farmers aren't sustainable or aren't, you know, doing things to improve their waste management practices or sustainability. And I think when you really go and look at it, that couldn't be further from the truth. I think farmers are some of the most sustainable people I know. Every single thing that enters into their farming system, you know, they don't want to see waste. They want to figure out how can I maximize the nutrients or maximize the value of everything and waste as little as possible. So really appreciate all the work you're doing with farmers across the country in developing this market and developing this product, and appreciate your time here today. Is there anything else before we close off that you want to touch on related to the 2020 field trials or any of the important topics we discussed here today?
Oh boy, I think at this point I'm about it.
Is that for phase three, episode three?
For phase three, let's come back in a month and we'll have more things to talk about, or in a couple months. So.
Sure. Well, if anybody has questions who's listening to this episode, please do not hesitate to reach out. You can find Alan, I think, on LinkedIn. I know you can find contact info on our team on our website, biostarrenewables.com. We also have a lot of great resources, including the 2020 field trials as a PDF, where you can go and read through all the different results. And certainly if you have questions about anything you heard on the podcast today or in reading that, or if you need to backtrack and go listen to the first episode from this two-part series, we welcome your questions, and we'll make sure we get those to Alan and get those answered. If anything that you heard is interesting, Alan, I'm gonna shell out your email address. It's aphilo@biostarrenewables.com. And you can reach out to Alan directly, or of course, contact us through our website. We're going to wrap it up. That is episode 2 of BioStar's 2020 Super 6 Organic Fertilizer Field Trials with our chief agronomist, Alan Philo. Alan, it's always a pleasure having you on the show, and we'll look forward to having you back soon.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it. Fun to be
here. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks.
Hello, and thank you for listening to Renewables, a podcast by BioStar, which aims to explore the current and future energy landscape in America.